The next matter, State versus Benson.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jennifer Dobson, and I represent Mr. Benson, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. The issue here is whether Mr. Benson was denied his right to a fair trial by bailiff misconduct. Here, the bailiff committed misconduct, violating RCW 4.44-300 and Criminal Rule 6.15-F1. And the state appears to concede this. Really, what we're talking about is the prejudicial impact. As a result of the misconduct, the jury was never provided clarification as to the scope of the charged act here and was permitted to convict Mr. Benson of an uncharged act. The jury was never directly informed or instructed that the basis of the state's assault charge was the specific act of shoulder checking or a shoulder bump.
In closing argument, the prosecutor apparently made the shoulder bump or checking or whatever you want to call it the basis of the charge, an election. And during the response, there was no comment to challenge that. So why is there an issue regarding the basis of the charge?
And the reason being is that we do have a jury here who indicated confusion. And we look at what their instructions were. And their instructions say that if the jury if the jury was instructed to disregard the prosecutor's argument if it's not supported by the instructions. So we go back to the instructions, and the instructions do not tell them that the specific incident, the specific act that was charged was the shoulder bump. So what we see here is sort of a systemic problem of allowing this election, and I know we do allow it in closing argument, but when there's confusion with the jury, and that was indicated here, then we have to have, the judge has to step in at some point and take some steps to prevent the defendant from being convicted of an uncharged act. That's a
well,
due process.
Aren't you speculating? I mean, the premise of your argument is that the court would have given a different instruction than what the bailiff said, which is read the instructions. So the premise of your argument is that if the bailiff had informed the judge, that the judge would have given some sort of instruction that you think would have been appropriate?
Actually, no, Your Honor. The premise of our argument is that the judge would have had to, and this would have been the same. We would have gotten to the same argument, which is, did due process require?
Well, what if the judge hadn't?
Then we'd be having this same argument. Does due process require that judge make some clarification? And we would point you to State versus Laramie, which says absolutely there is a requirement when there is this confusion and the judge is made aware of it, which should have happened here, then the court has an obligation to have some clarification. Now, what that would have been when the parties all got there and discussed, we're speculating now. Yes, we are, because that never happened. And that we have to look at this through the lens of bailiff misconduct, and we look at it's the state's burden here to show that there was no prejudicial effect, and it cannot reach that based on this record. And what we do is we look at was it possible that this jury convicted based on an uncharged act? Now, we are not delving into, I wish I could, but we are not delving into their thought processes that were written in their statements. We're staying away from that.
But wait, stop right there. You're contending that what some jurors thought about their deliberative process does not inhere in the verdict?
No, we're not actually going into the thought processes of how they reach their verdict. We cannot go into their thought process.
Agreed.
We can look at what they say in their statements to identify what was in the note and what the bailiff has said and what they heard. That's what we're looking at. And the fact that they said that they relied on an uncharged crime, we can't go there. When we're looking at prejudice, we look at that confusion. We look that they did not get any clarifying instruction. There was no arguments. The parties didn't have the chance to talk about that. So then we go and we look at, okay, did the charging document indicate that the specific act was a shoulder bump? No. Did the evidence that the state presented make that clear? We have the trial judge actually saying, no, it didn't. We have an election made in closing argument, but we also have a instruction that says you can disregard that if it's not consistent with the instructions. And we don't have an instruction here that tells them that. So what we have is the state has to come here and they have to say, beyond a reasonable doubt, this jury, there's no chance this jury convicted him of an uncharged act beyond the scope of what they charged, which was only the shoulder bump. And so we're not asking you to go into what these jurors said, and I would love to be able to do that, but we've been very careful. We understand the law on this. We understand we're not supposed to go into that. But then you look at the charging document, the evidence, the instructions, the fact that the argument didn't stick based on the question that the jurors have. And based on all of that, the state can't meet its burden of showing that there was no prejudice here. And if there's no further question, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
All right. You will have 4 minutes.
Thank you.
Morning. If it pleases the court, I'm James Westbrook, representing the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. The state of Washington is the respondent in this matter. Your Honor, counsel's right. We don't contest that there was a violation here. I think the bailiff's testimony establishes that there was an improper communication between the court and the jury. And we're asking this court, however, to find that the error was harmless. Primarily, we're asking the court to find that it was harmless because the instruction itself was correct and it was sufficient to direct the jury to the appropriate act. The harmless error cases in this area say that the improper communication between the court and the jury can be harmless if the communication was inconsequential. And the types of situations that have been found to be inconsequential are, for example, in Rice, where the defendant's confession was played to the jury outside the presence of the defendant. In Caliguri case, where the case where the taped confession was played for the jury, or sorry, taped conversations were played for the jury outside the defendant's presence. And in Caliguri, it even included statements that hadn't been admitted at trial. They found that to be an inconsequential communication.
The argument is that if properly communicated to the judge would have an obligation to have addressed the confusion and to have done more than said, read the instructions.
Right, and I don't believe that that's required by due process. That may be required if the instruction itself is deficient. One of the cases that counsel cited in her brief, I don't remember the name off the top of my head, refers to a defect that was in the charging document itself. The Laramie case that she just mentioned this morning, I apologize, I didn't read that one. But what cases like Russell from this court say is, you know, in Russell, you had the jury asking about the definition of a firearm, and the court replied without contacting the parties that the instruction means exactly what it says, which is essentially equivalent to what the judge did here, turning the jury back to its instructions, and that was held to be harmless.
Your opponent says that the judge would have had to have given some clarification, and I take that to mean perhaps to clarify that the shoulder bump was the basis of the charge. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't believe the judge had a duty to do anything beyond, say, refer to your instructions. It's possible that the judge could have said, you know, refer to instruction 17, because instruction 17 is two sentences long and says exactly what the jury needs to know, which is, in alleging that the defendant committed assault in the third degree, the state relies upon evidence regarding a single act constituting the alleged crime. To convict the defendant, you must unanimously agree that this specific act was proved. And in the prosecutor's closing argument, she unequivocally referred to the shoulder check. Defense counsel embraced that election insofar as he referred to it also in the context of his argument and simply argued that it was insufficient to show an assault because it was questionable whether that was an offensive touching. So honestly, I think what happened here is the jury looked at this situation, saw that there were actually several other very clear assaults the defendant had committed, and was questioning, well, why don't we just stuck with the shoulder check when he also attacked the officer, grabbed him around the neck area, punched him, put him up against the wall, all those sorts of other things. Which brings me to the supplemental authority I just supplied yesterday. I'm not sure if the court received it or not. I think it's relevant to this harmlessness question that at bottom, the confusion here, if there was any confusion, wasn't really about a unanimity problem. This was a continuing assault that we had here. It was a melee. It was a scrum. And to say that we had to, as a constitutional matter, choose between these various acts that could have constituted an assault, I think is incorrect. Now, the prosecutor did.
Are you saying continuing course? Is
that, yes.
Okay.
The prosecutor did make that election. There was no discussion in the record about it. There was some question about whether she had to, but nobody seemed to focus on that line of cases saying that if you had a continuing assault, you didn't have to select just one punch or one push. But I think that at this point, the court can consider it just for purposes of harmless error analysis. As they say at bottom, this isn't a unanimity problem. But even if it was, directing the jury back to instruction number 17 would have clearly, the instruction that they had would have clearly answered the question, and there's no reason to believe that they strayed from that. If the court doesn't have any questions, I would rather not get into the details of the jury declarations. I think the counsel is correct, especially under the more recent case of Long v. Brusco Tug, the matters that are contained in there shouldn't be considered, but I don't think you need to get to those. We ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I would direct your attention to RP 11. This is right as the trial was starting, and there was a bill of particulars, and this is not a continuous offense. They specifically said the assault was based on the single act of the shoulder check, and the defense relied on this moving forward. So this is not a continuous offense, and that can't save them here. This is also, they're attempting to recraft the argument and say that the prejudice was a lack of unanimity. Our point is that, no, it's a different thread of due process. The problem here is that the jury could have, and it's a strong possibility they did, convict our client of something beyond the charged act. And that's the problem. That's what they were struggling with. That's what they asked for instruction on. That's what their jury question was about. And they were just told to go back to instruction 17, which says that you have to agree unanimously on the single act. Well, here, as the state has conceded here, there were multiple single acts.
You have the same argument if the jury had never had the interaction with the bailiff.
We wouldn't have that question here, and I think the case law is pretty...
Is that because the instructions were sufficient?
No, we would presume that they followed the instruction, and we wouldn't and we have case law that says that this election is fine.
I guess what I'm asking is, if the manner in which the attorneys presented the case and the manner in which the judge instructed the jury would have been sufficient in the absence of the interaction between the jurors and the bailiff, why is it that the interaction between the jurors and the bailiff raises a question that otherwise would not exist?
And we have cited several cases in our briefing that when the jury has confusion about the law, and that then the judge has to step forward. And State v. Laramie, I'm going to quote here, the error was necessarily prejudicial because under the instructions given, the jury could have found the defendant guilty of uncharged means. And even this court's decision...
That presupposes then a case where the instructions were not sufficient.
There In this situation, what we have is we have the jury's question indicating that these are not sufficient. And the case law that we've cited is that there are cases.
The instructions were not sufficient, and the argument was identical, and the presentation was identical. Wouldn't it necessarily have to be so that you would have the same claim, regardless of whether you had the interaction between the bailiff and the jurors or not?
What we have is we can look at these general instructions, and there has been a presumption in the law that these are fine. But what we have here is that, in fact, we have a situation where the general instructions are not fine. And there are cases that we cite where this exists. And that's where the due process duty pops up. And this case, in this court, in State v. Campbell, recently stated that the state cites Campbell for the proposition that the trial court has discretion whether to give an instruction. But the very next line that they leave off, this court says, but where a jury question indicates an erroneous understanding by the jury of the applicable law, the trial court must issue a corrective instruction. That's from this court, and that's and cites State v. Davenport, which is a Washington Supreme Court case. So that is where we're resting here, and there was a particular act here, and the jury could have convicted beyond that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The